Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Sophia Tsai, and I represent the petitioner, Shelter Mutual Insurance Company, in this case. We're before the court today really on two main legal issues. One is whether step-down limits for permissive drivers in automobile liability insurance policies are valid and enforceable in Colorado. And then secondly, whether, with the repeal of the No Fault Act...
Sorry, Ms. Tsai?
Yes.
I didn't mean to interrupt you so quickly, but... The Court of Appeals didn't rule on that issue, right?
It did not.
So why are we here to decide that? I'm a little confused by that. I understand the state filed, Division of Insurance filed an amicus brief.
Well, it was an issue raised in the petition, actually it was the primary issue to be brought before the court. And then secondly, I guess the sub-issue that's very specific to the facts of this case, there was a notice issue as to whether Shelter adequately provided notice to its insured with respect to revisions to its policy, including the step-down limit, which the Court of Appeals, as you're aware, found that notice was insufficient, and therefore the step-down limit was invalid for that reason alone. Should this court decide to reverse that decision by the Court of Appeals, which I would ask that you do, then the validity of the step-down limit in general then absolutely becomes an issue. The second one, which the Court of Appeals did clearly discuss in this case, is whether the owner's insurer for a vehicle is obligated to provide primary insurance, or whether the holding of Avis versus Allstate, which this court issued and which was the basis of the Court of Appeals opinion, whether the rationale of that case holds true to make the owner's insurer and the permissive driver's insurer co-primary should they both contain mutually repugnant excess clauses. I'd like to start with the two larger legal questions before getting to the more specific notice issue. With respect to step-down limits for permissive drivers, obviously Shelter's argued that these are enforceable under Colorado law. The state of the law in Colorado is clearly stated in Section 10.4.623 that limitations in auto liability policies are allowed in Colorado so long as they don't violate any Colorado law or policy. In this case, Shelter's policy otherwise meets the provisions for auto liability policies. It doesn't dilute coverage, condition coverage, or otherwise limit required coverage as required under the state's insurance law. There are a number of cases that are cited in opposition to the step-down limit that are Colorado cases, but I would note that those cases don't actually address the issue of whether the step-down limit itself is valid. Really, those cases go to impermissible exclusions or provisions of insurance policies that attempt to exclude certain individuals from the definition of insured, rather than whether certain insureds can be subject to a step-down limit. I think it's undisputed that the law in Colorado is clear that you can't omit people that are using a vehicle from being insured unless it's allowed by the statute. However, that's not what Shelter's policy does in this case. There's also been a suggestion by the Division of Insurance and Mid-Century that because step-down limits are not expressly allowed by Colorado law, that this one in Shelter's policy should be stricken and invalidated. However, I think that argument is actually directly contrary to the law set forth in Section 10.4.623, which specifically says limitations in auto liability policies are allowed so long as they otherwise comply with the law. I think as a matter of policy, it would not be good policy to reach that level of micromanagement of the insurance industry as well, to prohibit any limitations on insurance policy unless the legislature is specifically allowed for it.
Well, it may be, but aren't we pretty clear in our prior cases, and doesn't public policy require an explicit notice of a significant change like this, rather than forcing the insured to read and parse the entire policy?
I would agree, Your Honor, that Colorado law calls for notice to the insured of any limitations on coverage. I think, and just jump over to my notice section. We've got some differences here between the prior law in Colorado with respect to notice, which the primary case is the TEEP versus Blue Cross Blue Shield case, which involves a health insurance policy in which Blue Cross Blue Shield actually advised their insured that there were no change in benefits, that the insured going from one policy to the next policy periods, the renewal, the insured was advised that the benefits were not changing when in fact that wasn't true at all. I think in this case, the changes to Shelter's policy in Mr. Brown's policy that went into effect right before the subject accident happened in this case, it was a significant change. It wasn't just we're adding a couple more exclusions. It was a complete rearranging of the policy, and there was a significant risk if Shelter were to try to identify each one of those that it might miss one. I think on the flip side of that, you could make the argument, as the division has presented to the court, that you know Shelter did submit the list of forms that had changed in its renewed policy, as well as kind of a summary of the changes that were in there. I think on the flip side, if Shelter would have presented that list to their insured, we would probably still be here today because it was a lengthy list. It was a summary list, and we...
Could you just hit the high points? What were the major changes?
The step-down limit, Your Honor, and the addition of the other insurance clauses.
But the same premium is being charged, right? There's no reduction in the premium.
That is true, Your Honor.
Right. So the consumer's getting less value out of payment, and it's not clear that, you know, when consumers just get a renewal and they get charged the same premium, that there would be any significant change. Might be another cosmetic changes to these things. You know, you read those credit card forms and it's hard to tell whether it's substantive or procedural or just somebody chose some other language to say the same thing to clarify. I mean, so how's a consumer supposed to figure this out?
Well, you know, I think I would respectfully disagree that the named insurer, the one who pays the premium and buys the policy, is getting any significant reduction in coverage. In fact, they're not getting any reduction in coverage at all. This is a step-down limit that applies only to permissive drivers.
That's a step-down, isn't it? From, I guess I'd like to hear you address the public policy argument that the division insurance makes about how it waters down or changes the definition of insured under 10.4601, subsection 5, which is what I think, and also how that applies to, why wouldn't that apply, that same argument apply to your second issue, which is that when you insure a car, you know, the liability should be the primary driver, not that of a complying permissive driver.
Well, I think with respect to the divisions of insurance, Your Honor, there is no change in the definition of an insured. An insured is an insured. In fact, Shelter's definition of an insured is substantially similar to the statutory definition of an insured.
Well, but doesn't it exempt permissive drivers for the excess part?
The excess part applies across the board with respect to the other insurance
clauses. Right, with liability. So therefore, you're saying that I think that's inconsistent with what the definition of owner and policy, or maybe it isn't. Maybe I'm
wrong. Well, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, you tell me.
With respect to the other insurance clauses, I think that maybe the distinction is, and if I've misunderstood the question, I apologize, but the distinction would be between escape clauses, which we would all agree are not enforceable in Colorado, as opposed to this, which is an other insurance clause, which merely says, should there be nothing, no other policy, will be primary. But if there is other insurance that applies to this subject accident, then we are going to be excess. Under the clearly stated law in Allstate versus Avis, really, as a practical matter, what that means is we're going to be co-primary. And in fact, you know, MidCentury's policy has an other insurance clause. I mean, nearly every auto liability policy that's issued today has another insurance clause. If I could touch on the reduction in coverage issue.
Could I just ask you a question about this? I just want to make sure I understand your argument. You acknowledge that there's a requirement in case law that the notice of changes be specific. And you're not suggesting that we should change that requirement. You indicate, however, that because of the extensive changes in coverage here, that the notice that there are extensive changes meets that requirement. Well, do I understand your argument right, or have I messed that up a little bit?
I think you've accurately summarized it, Your Honor.
Okay.
With respect to this case, a shelter opted for the advisements to the insured that there was probably a reduction in coverage, and that's why they encouraged them to have the face-to-face meeting or at least the discussion with their agent so that that can be personally explained, as opposed to putting out a laundry list of the changes to the policy.
So the discomfort, I guess, I have with that approach, and maybe you can help me with it, it seems as though, well, the requirement is specificity. If we follow your approach, the more specific changes there are, the more you can just generalize and give a very broad notice that isn't specific at all. So it's like, if there's one specific change, it seems pretty clear you have to notify of it. But if there's 10 specific changes, then you just have to say there are changes. And that seems somehow inconsistent.
Well, I think the issue in this case wasn't it wasn't just limitations in coverage that were changed, and as opposed to saying, you know, we've moved section one that used to be on page 5 to page 20, and then changed a couple of words which may or may not be material, you know, in addition to saying, well, here's all the changes that could affect your coverage in particular, shelter opted for the advisement that it gave. As I indicated earlier, the named insured, I don't believe, is really faced with reduction in coverage, even though he or she may still be paying the same premium. The risk...
Do you mean personal coverage?
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying, there's not a reduction in coverage? Because there's a reduction in coverage for a permissive user.
Yes.
So you're just saying that the primary driver doesn't have a diminution in his coverage.
Yes, Your Honor. And really, I think the important point there is when an insurance company writes a policy for any particular insured, it knows the risk. You know, the insured fills out an application, makes representations on the application with regard to driving history, whatever questions the insurance company may ask, so that they can get an accurate picture of the risk. With respect to permissive drivers, the insurance company has absolutely no control over who might be a permissive driver or who might be their insured. And
this has always been perplexing to me, and I think from the first day I got on this court there was an issue like this. But the point is that when you buy coverage, you know, you want to take care of your friends, you know, you're coming to town, or, you know, you're going to be named in the lawsuit as well because you lent the keys out. I'm just not getting why this package, you know, that's reduced from the coverage when you hand the keys to somebody and say, you know, I really appreciate you, go pick up my grandmother from the nursing home, I can't make it. Then, you know, you're paying the same premium, and then that extra protection is not there. I don't understand the argument.
Well, what it does get the named insured is a guarantee that there will still be coverage left in the event they're pursued on a different claim, on a theory of negligent entrustment. The facts of the case that I've dealt with, I think in the past year, involving this a step-down issue, is the named insured loaned the car to his son. I think that's probably foreseeable, but then the son went on to loan the car to a friend that the named insured had no idea, didn't know the friend, didn't know that the car was going to be loaned to that friend. The friend subsequently took the car on a drug run and got in an accident. And the named insured did get sued out of that on the theory of negligent entrustment. The purpose and the reasoning that Shelter employed in employing the step-down limit is to make sure that there's still coverage for that named insured in those situations, and that coverage isn't exhausted on a suit or a claim against the permissive driver. So really, the ultimate goal is still to protect the named insured, who is the one that's paying the premium and the one that the insurance company agreed to insure in the first place. With respect to some of the other policy issues, I think we would all agree that the existing policy in Colorado is to avoid inadequate compensation to the victims of car accidents. And that's why the legislature has set minimum limits of 25, 50, 15, for auto liability. And even with the step-down provision, Shelter's policy still complies with this requirement and meets the public policy of adequately compensating accident victims. The argument's been made that this could lead to disastrous consequences because that's just not going to be enough to compensate victims of car accidents. But as it has been discussed in the briefs, the legislature has set these limits, and I think it is really not, at least my place as a lawyer, and I'm not sure it's for the courts to decide what sufficient compensation is for accident victims. We've got to leave it to the legislature, and that's what they've done in setting those minimum limits. Another competing policy here is Colorado's policy of freedom of contract. Insurance policies, as you know, in Colorado are contracts, and they're interpreted according to contract law in Colorado, and parties are free to contract.
How does that fit with the idea that insurance contracts are usually considered contracts of adhesion because the purchaser, the individual, has such little bargaining power by comparison?
I don't think that absolutely prohibits an insurance company from imposing conditions and limitations, exclusions into its policy. And that's, I mean, really where the bargaining power comes in for the consumer is, if you're charging too high a premium for what I'm getting from you, then I'm going to go switch to another insurance policy. I don't think the fact that insurance policies are generally considered adhesion contracts really affects the ability of an insurer to
I was just trying to relate it to your freedom of contract policy argument. How do you see those two concepts interacting?
I think the freedom of contract with respect to the insurance company still exists. I think there obviously are issues with the adhesion, and this may be an issue really that is more appropriately addressed with the excess issue, in that where you've really got two insurers trying to draft their policies so that they can avoid primary coverage. At this point, would like to turn to the excess issue. As I indicated earlier, I think the law is already set in Colorado with the Allstate versus Avis case, which flat out holds if you've got two insurance policies, or basically insuring contracts, that are seeking to avoid primary coverage, those two clauses are mutually repugnant, and both insurers are obligated to provide primary coverage on a dollar-for-dollar basis until their respective limits are exhausted. MidCentury has tried to distinguish the facts of this case from the facts of Allstate versus Avis on the grounds that that involved a rental car contract and that it was a private contract. But I think the bottom line is the analysis is still the same. At the end of the day, we still have two insurance policies that are trying to avoid primary coverage. Both of them are trying to avoid primary coverage for an auto accident. The rationale of Allstate versus Avis still applies to make them both co-primary. In this case, I think the Court of Appeals got the primacy issue right. Mandatory insurance coverage in Colorado can contain an excess clause, such as that contained in Shelter's and such as that contained in MidCentury's policy. And there's no prohibition to such clauses in the Colorado statutes. Since the repeal of the No-Fault Act, there is no statutory obligation that the owner's insurer provide primary coverage.
Could you just kind of work us through a problem, an example, just so we can see this a little more clearly? So you lend, I'm insured, I lend my car to my daughter, she lends it to somebody else, he gets in an accident, he's insured by somebody else. It's your position then that I, as the insured of my car and the kid who was driving the car, should be paying under both of our insurance policies on a dollar-for-dollar basis?
Assuming they both have other insurance clauses.
And by dollar-for-dollar, if it's $20,000, I pay 10, he pays 10. Is that what you mean exactly by dollar-by-dollar?
Assuming, let's say, the value of the claim is $100,000, and one policy has limits of 25 and the other has limits of 50. I think they both pay dollar for dollar until they've each paid 25. And then once the 25 limit is exhausted, then the other insurer with its $50,000 limits continues paying the rest of the 25.
Okay, I just want to make sure I understood your language. Thanks.
Previously, when the No Fault Act was in effect in Colorado, there was a specific statutory requirement calling for the owner's insurer to provide primary PIP benefits. That law, as we all know, has been repealed, and at this point in time, there is no statutory requirement that the owner's insurer be primary. The law, compulsory liability insurance in Colorado exists to protect accident victims, and as the Court of Appeals noted in this case, so long as there is insurance coverage, the courts shouldn't be concerned with who's providing it, particularly in light of the Allstate versus Avis case.
So can I just stop you there? So what's your position with regard to the repeal of No Fault? You think it had no effect, essentially, in the line of cases?
I think what it's done, as far as this issue goes, is it's left it up to the contractual language in the various policies. You know, if one policy contains an excess clause, it says that this policy is going to provide excess coverage only. If there's other insurance and the other doesn't, then the one that doesn't ought to be primary. So I think it really, what it's done is it's taken it out of the statutes and left it.
And so there's no longer a statutory requirement, and that's all it did. That's all the repeal did.
With respect to this issue, yes.
Okay. It did much more, correct, but with respect to what you're arguing here today. Thank
yes,
you.
Your Honor.
Could you address the public policy enforced argument that Mid-Century makes about why your excess policy is unenforceable?
I think it comes down to what the Court of Appeals decided, in that the point of the laws in Colorado are to provide compensation for victims of auto accidents. If the permissive drivers didn't have insurance, or if that insurance policy I guess we're looking at the situation where the permissive driver doesn't have insurance, then the owner's insurer, in this case Shelter, it does kick in. The coverage is there. I really don't think the policy issue of whether auto accident victims are fully compensated really turns on who's going to be primary. I think as long as the coverage is there, and in this case, really, we've got twice as much coverage because they're both co-primary. A lot of the law in Colorado as well, or at this point in time, really, auto liability coverage is tied not just to the ownership of a vehicle, it's tied to the operation, use, and ownership of the vehicle. Which I think supports the argument that it's not just the owner's insurer that should be primary anymore. But, you know, under that definition of ownership, operation, and use, there's no reason why the permissive users, using the same rationale, you could reach the same conclusion that the permissive user's insurer ought to be primary.
I guess that's what's always been confusing to everybody is, are you insuring the use of the car or the driver, whichever driver is using the car? And you say now it's all three of those factors, but sometimes that obviously breeds different results.
Well, with respect to primacy,
it'd be very easy if just each person bought insurance, and irrespective of what car they were driving, they were insured. that we insure cars, right?
I think we insure cars as well as drivers.
Right, and that's what I'm pointing out. That's what makes this a little bit more complicated.
Well, I'm not sure it does, Your Honor.
Okay, explain to me why it doesn't.
We insure cars, we insure drivers. The point of the liability insurance is to make sure that there is insurance money there for whoever your insured runs into or your insured vehicle runs into. As long as both of those have insurance, they ought to both contribute to compensate that accident victim. You know, there's nothing that specifically points to which one should be first. I think we all agree that the accident victim should be compensated and that insurance ultimately is what pays it. The question is who's primary, and under the, you know, plain language of the various contracts that are involved, it's both of them. I think that is supported by the argument that was presented with regard to this total policy insuring intent. The total policy insuring intent with both the owner's policy and the driver's policy is what we've just discussed, in that victims should be compensated. It's not that one should be primary irrespective of policy language.
Can I ask a question? Is the effect of that sort of approach about co-primaries when each provision of the contract nullifies itself in order to protect the victims, is the effect of that approach basically then that the law doesn't purport to require anybody to be primary, and instead you're always co-insurers unless one insurance company was hapless enough to not put in a clause indicating that it would be secondary?
I think that could be the result if one insurance company, or both insurance companies, were to not have those clauses.
So in effect, you need to put in the clause making yourself secondary just to ensure that you'll be co-primary. Is that
okay? Basically, yes, Your Honor. And as a practical matter, that's what I've seen. I've not seen an insurance, an auto liability policy that doesn't say, well, actually broader than auto liability, that doesn't say that we're excess over anything else, absent obviously the pure excess policies. Which, under the total policy insuring intent, argument would be, unless you're a pure excess policy, that's exactly what the argument would be, unless you're a pure excess policy, then your total policy insuring intent would be to provide primary coverage. We kind of discussed notice earlier, so at this point in time, I'd like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Kimberly Shutt, registration number 25947, and I'm here on behalf of Mid-Century Insurance Company here today. I want to begin by first thanking the court for agreeing to take up these issues, which we consider to be very important. And unless the court has specific questions regarding the notice and step-down provisions, I'd like to focus the bulk of my arguments on the other insurance clause, and we've agreed to reserve 5 minutes of our time for the Division of Insurance Amicus Council to address the step-down provision arguments as well. With respect to the other insurance clause, I think there are three premises that are very crucial to the court's understanding and analysis of these issues. The first premise is that insurance in general is based upon the notion of trying to calculate as best possible the known risks. And as this court recognized in both Travelers Indemnity Company versus Barnes and Worcester versus State Farm, in the context of automobile liability insurance, that calculation of risk is based very much on the specific vehicle that's being used. What kind of vehicle is it? Is it a big SUV or is it a small hybrid? Where is that vehicle principally located and being used? Is it in a congested urban setting or is it out in the country? Who are the insureds that are primarily using this vehicle? Based on their age, their driving record? Are they the type of insureds that are expected to use this particular vehicle responsibly and exercise good judgment in who they loan that particular vehicle to? It's based upon these factors that an insurance company providing insurance for a particular vehicle rates that policy and charges its customer. And it's precisely this focus being on the particular vehicle being used that we have the type of excess provision that MidCentury has in its policy, which applies only in the instances of a non-owned vehicle. It's because an insurer cannot analyze those factors for an unknown vehicle that it's insured might be using as a permissive driver. And it's for that reason that an insurance company tries to minimize its exposure and reduce the rate it has to charge to its insured by saying, we will only provide excess coverage in those instances when you are driving a non-owned vehicle. And it's based upon the premise that an insurer who insures that particular vehicle is in a better position to consider those factors and analyze the risk and provide appropriate primary coverage for that vehicle when it's being used either by the owner or by a permissive user. I submit to you that this is also the premise that underlies the total policy insuring intent test, which has been utilized in Minnesota, and which is the modern trend is recognized by Couch on Insurance, as we've cited in our briefs. And I would submit to you that the total policy insuring intent test is not as simplified as what Council for Shelter has suggested. It's not merely a focus on providing coverage for an automobile accident. There are specific factors, among them the particular vehicle being used and which insurers providing coverage for that vehicle, that is factored into application of that test. So we ask that you keep in mind that it's insurance is generally about assessing the risks, and that comes into play in why this particular provision is in MidCentury's policy and specific to use of a non-owned vehicle. The second premise that or principle that I think is very important to emphasize here, and I think it's related to the first premise, is that our entire statutory scheme, if you read our insurance statutes regarding liability insurance, they are all focused on ensuring a particular, the owner or registrant of a vehicle is required to provide insurance for that vehicle for covering liability for its ownership and use. Significantly, there's no counter requirement for a driver to obtain insurance to cover him regardless of what vehicle he might be operating. He may not even own a vehicle. There's no requirement for him to go out and obtain insurance if he's going to borrow a vehicle from somebody else. If you read the statute as a whole, as well as the purposes that it's designed to serve, it's all based on this notion that the insurer who provides coverage for a specific vehicle is in the best position to analyze the risk and provide appropriate coverage for that particular vehicle. The third principle then, which I think is very crucial, one which courts have often been too quick to throw up their hands and say, oh, these policies are mutually repugnant, is that the excess provision that we have in MidCentury's policy is very different from the insurance clause that Shelter has in its policy in the manner which it's trying to use that other insurance clause. MidCentury's excess insurance clause is tied only to use of a non-owned vehicle. Shelter is saying that if there's any other insurance out there, even though we're insuring this specific vehicle, we are only co-primary. That's not to say that that particular provision is invalid in all instances, and I have a hypothetical which I think would well illustrate how these two different insurance provisions might come into play and be used in a valid manner. Let's say that Bruce Brown loans his car to Mark Brown, who's not only Bruce's son, but also his employee in a family-owned business. And Bruce Brown has his own personal liability, auto liability insurance with Shelter, But he also has a commercial liability policy, which provides coverage for that specific vehicle when it's being used for business purposes. Mark Brown borrows his dad's car to make a delivery for that business, as well as to run a personal errand for his father. And in the course of doing so, gets into an accident with Virginia Johnson. Mark Brown has insurance with Farmers, which provides that it's excess when a non-owned vehicle is being used. I submit to you that the other insurance clause that Shelter has in its policy could validly be used and would be mutually repugnant to any similar provision that might be in the business policy that covers that specific vehicle. However, it cannot be used to shift that responsibility to provide primary coverage to an excess insurer who is only providing coverage for on an excess basis for a non-owned vehicle. It is for that reason that I submit that the two policies here are not mutually repugnant, and I think you can get there whether you use the total policy insuring intent test that's been utilized in some jurisdictions. If you view it as different layers of insurance and find that the excess policy here for a non-owned vehicle was not other collectible insurance unless and until the primary insurance was exhausted. In my hypothetical, that would be by both the policy covering the business as well as the policy covering Bruce Brown's vehicle. In this particular case, it's not collectible insurance until after Shelter's policy on that particular vehicle has been exhausted.
So, yes. Are you abandoning the argument that Shelter's policy is unenforceable because it's against public policy? Based on the statutory analysis,
I believe that that policy provision is contrary to public policy to the extent that it's trying to be used in the manner it is here in this case.
Could you explain that more detail? That's really your second reason, isn't it?
Well,
I mean, I think you've in your argument before us, you've kind of fused your particular policy in the terms of it with the public policy, at least in my mind, public policy. Argument.
Our position that it's against public policy for Shelter to be able to use its other insurance clause to shift primary coverage to the excess insurer only covering the non-owned vehicle on a excess basis. And the reason being, it does have a contrary purpose to the No Fault Act. It's not just simply a matter of saying, well, as long as there's some insurance available, then we're all good because the accident victim gets compensation. It all plays back to my first point in about trying to calculate the known risks. If this court is...
Wait a second. That seems like that's clearly a legislative determination or administrative determination how insurance rates are decided. I mean, I'm not arguing with you. I'm sure you're right. But I don't know that it deals with a specific statutory contradiction, and that's what kind of interests me. How do you get there?
How I get there is that, first of all, I don't think it requires any kind of policy decision by this court. I think if the court finds that any decision the court would make here finding that Shelter's policy is indeed primary is consistent with our entire statutory scheme as it's been in place for the last couple of decades. It's not requiring a policy provision, but if this court instead finds that that's not how our statute's set up and that Shelter can shift primary responsibility for providing coverage for a particular vehicle to another insurance company that only covers the permissive user, it does have very real-world consequences that are contrary to the stated purpose of the act. Because what's going to happen is if an insurer has to provide potentially primary coverage for a vehicle that's not owned by its insured when it's being operated by a permissive user, and has to be prepared to do so potentially on a co-primary basis when it cannot assess the risks of what that vehicle might be, then the consequence is going to be that insurers are going to have to charge its insureds for covering that unknown risk on a co-primary or primary basis. And then in turn, it's going to result in more people being uninsured or underinsured, directly contrary to the purposes of the No Fault Act.
I think I understand most of what you said.
Okay.
But it seems that, you know, Judge Webb and the Court of Appeals had two basic arguments. One is the one your opponent made, is that who cares who's primary or secondary as long as there's coverage. But secondly, his point was that the legislature knows how to dictate and say and talk about primary and secondary coverage as they did in the No-Fault Act, and they didn't do it here. So I guess what I'm interested in is what is the statutory construction that makes it contrary to public policy? I mean, I think your argument is quite attractive, but I want to know what the statutory basis for finding that, because that's
okay.
All we've ever said. And we know that the purpose of regulating insurance is to compensate victims and so forth. We got that down. And the reason I asked Ms. Tsai the question I did was because I thought some of the argument that was made by the Division of Insurance actually worked, because it was a watering down of the definition of insurance. Now, maybe I'm wrong. I certainly don't have the, you know, I don't have the grasp of the statutes, and I'm sure everybody here does.
Okay. Well, with respect, from a statutory standpoint, I disagree with the Court of Appeals' conclusion that because there's no specific provision in the statutory scheme making one insurer primary over the other, I disagree with that. I believe that conclusion was based upon the former Section 10.4.707.4 discussed in Barnes, and that specific provision applied only to PIP coverage. What this court said in Barnes was that it was inappropriate for the Division of Insurance to apply that specific provision to liability insurance as well. And in doing so, it said that interpretation does not conform to the stated legislative purpose of the Act, is not consistent with all other portions of the Act, and changes longstanding insurance practices. The point of that specific section, which sunset with the No-Fault Act, was to carve out an exclusion to what we believe is the overall picture and purpose and requirement of the Act, and that is the insurer for a particular vehicle is required to provide primary coverage. It's what I submit is the very reason why the legislature has not made any additional changes to that statute and carved out any had to state a particular rule with regard to primacy, because as this court recognized in Barnes, that's the way it is that the vehicle insurer is supposed to provide primary coverage.
So the provision in Shelter's contract in their policy that would make them secondary, you're saying violates the statute because it runs counter to what the general intent and purposes of the statute are.
Correct.
But nothing more specific than that in terms of violating a provision. Is that right?
I don't think there's any, we can't say that there's a specific stated primacy rule in the statute which Shelter's attempt to enforce its other insurance clause here violates. But you're correct. What we're saying is it violates the entire statutory scheme as a whole, as well as longstanding insurance practices, which this court recognized in Barnes.
Follow up 1 second on that. So they've got a very express provision in their contract. And to get around that, you have to be saying that provision is barred by the statute. Is that right?
Well, it's barred to the extent they're trying to shift primary coverage to the insurer for a permissive user. I think my hypothetical illustrates some instances when it could come into play appropriately when there's an issue about whether there's another insurer for that vehicle that might be able to step up on a primary basis as well.
That kind of wind up saying, well, it's barred to the extent that it has an effect that the statute really didn't contemplate or want to have?
Exactly.
Okay.
Again, I'm asking the court to find that these two particular provisions are not mutually repugnant, that there's a specific purpose and justification for the excess insurance clause that's in Mid-Century's policy, and to hold that Shelter cannot use its other insurance clause to shift that responsibility to provide primary coverage to Mid-Century in this particular case.
Remind me, the Court of Appeals applied to Allstate on this issue, so.
It did rely upon Allstate, and as we've argued in our briefs, I believe Allstate is a different case. Although I've read Allstate, both this court's opinion in Allstate and as well as the Court of Appeals decision, and the exact verbiage that were in the two policies is still unclear to me, but it appears that both policies covered the driver renter. The renter had purchased additional coverage to cover his use of that vehicle. And so this court viewed those two clauses as excess and found them to be mutually repugnant. I think that's a different situation here where we have one policy that covers the owner and permissive use of that vehicle, and you have a policy that covers Mr. Mark Brown. I think there's also a basis for distinguishing that case on the grounds that in a rental context, there is freedom of contract as opposed to what happened here. A renter can go to Avis and say, I want to rent a car and I'm willing to pay a higher amount for you to provide me some additional coverage. That doesn't happen in the typical permissive user setting where, you know, Bruce Brown loans his, tosses the keys to his car to his son and says, you know, sure, you can borrow my car. There's no talk of, well, I'll pay you if your insurance also covers me for this particular accident on a primary basis. I would submit that this case is actually more akin to U.S. Fidelity and Guarantee versus Budget Rent-A-Car, which was a case this court decided in 1993, and that Judge Kirschbaum's concurring opinion in that case is dead on to the argument that we're making here. I would ask the court to adopt a bright line rule saying under our statutory scheme that the insurance company for a particular vehicle is indeed does have the responsibility to provide primary coverage. I would submit to you that unless and until we have that sort of rule in place, these issues are going to continue to arise because insurance companies are always trying to calculate the risk that's involved, and it's hard to do that if they're going to be required to provide primary coverage either on a co-basis or otherwise for an unknown vehicle where it doesn't know where it's going to be operated and under what circumstances. As we've cited in our brief, the Supreme Courts and several other states have taken that step in the last 10 to 12 years based on very similar statutory schemes to what we have in Colorado. Those states include Nebraska, Illinois, Delaware, Rhode Island, Hawaii, and for reasons that would be sound justification for doing so here. With respect to the step-down clause, the problem that we have is that Shelter is essentially issuing a 1-2 punch here. It tries to shift primary coverage that it's obligated to provide under our statute, and not only shift part of that coverage to another insurer, but also to reduce the amount that's available for permissive users, even though permissive users are defined to be insureds under our statutory scheme. I think the Court of Appeals correctly decided that there was insufficient notice here. Under this court's holding in Cyprex Amex Minerals, an insurer seeking to restrict coverage must not only use clear and unequivocal language, but must also call such limiting conditions to the attention of its insured. There was no such notice here. They essentially said there's changes to your policy that might affect your coverage. It doesn't say reduce your coverage. And it's up to you to check the fine print of your policy to discover what those changes might be. There's no reason why Shelter couldn't have outlined those two very major changes for Mr. Brown. And I think the record's very clear here that he had no idea that those coverages were inserted into his policy. The declarations page continued to reflect the amount of coverage he thought he bought and had in place for his car, whether it was being driven by him or his son as a permissive user, and that he was charged the same premium for that coverage, even though it was reduced without his knowledge. I think the court would be acting consistently with the precedent in this jurisdiction by finding that indeed that was insufficient notice. It need not even get to the issue of whether or not it's valid on its face. We would submit that indeed it is not. That it is in fact a dilution of the liability coverage that Mr. Brown had in place. It's the jurisprudence in this jurisdiction doesn't find such policy provisions to be a dilution of coverage simply if it keeps the same minimum limits in place. It just talks about a dilution of the required coverage. The required coverage here was liability coverage. Mr. Brown specifically paid a higher premium to purchase greater coverage in compliance with the Act to provide adequate compensation to accident victims. Expected that was going to be in place regardless of who was driving his car. Again, I submit that that's particularly troublesome now that the PIP laws have sunset and an accident victim must now look pretty much primarily to liability insurance to cover their accident-related injuries. They no longer receive medical benefits from their own auto insurer, and they have no control whatsoever over what amounts might be available. So in summary, I'm asking the court to take this 1-2 punch away from Shelter, to find that its other insurance clause is not a proper vehicle for shifting primary coverage to Mid-Century, to recognize that these two policies provisions are indeed not mutually repugnant, and find that Shelter must provide primary insurance here, and that Mid-Century's policy only provides excess. Ideally, we'd like you to rule as a bright line rule that the insurer for a vehicle under our statutory scheme does in fact have to provide that primary coverage, and also find that its step down provision is invalid, certainly because of improper notice, but also invalid as a matter of law. Thank you, Your Honors. I'll turn the podium over to counsel for the Division of Insurance.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Todd Larson. I'm with the Attorney General's Office, and I represent the Colorado Division of Insurance. I'd like to thank you on behalf of the division for allowing them to participate in the oral argument today. There's several important issues before the court today. The one that I'd like to focus on is whether Shelter's step provision limiting the amount of liability coverage for permissive drivers and step-down provisions generally are permissible. The division believes that step-down provisions like Shelter's are against or violate Colorado law and are against public policy.
Can you give me a definition of that, just so I understand for sure what you're talking about when you use that term?
Step-down provision? Basically, if an insured buys 100, 300 limits of liability coverage into their policy. In this case, Mr. Brown thought he was getting coverage for himself as the named insured, for his resident relatives, and permissive drivers. Shelter's policy takes the permissive driver part of insured and steps down their coverage to the statutory minimums, which were 25 and 50. So of the three types of insureds, named insured, resident relative, and permissive driver, the permissive driver is getting minimum limits of liability coverage, and that's how the step down provision works.
So step down means lower coverage?
Yes, yes, ma'am.
Is that all it means?
In this case, yes.
Okay.
Lower coverage for some class of people who are covered. Is that what, do you apply the term? Meaning whenever you apply, whenever the contract provides different coverage for different people?
No, it would be, it's a term unique to the facts of this case. I mean, it could conceivably apply to other coverages, other insureds, but in this case, we're talking about liability coverage and stepping down a type of insured person, a permissive driver, to minimal limits. Okay? At the core of Shelter's argument is the step-down provision is 10-4-6-20, which sets forth the basic limits of liability coverage. using this statute, Shelter argues that it can have effectively changed the statutory definition of insured, and or that its step-down provision is a proper condition or exclusion under title or section 10.4.623. Now, somebody in Colorado can bargain for and get minimal coverage. That's under 10.4.620, but when they do so, all insureds get the same coverage. That would be the named insured, the resident relatives, and the permissive drivers. That's a negotiated coverage.
And what's the basis for saying they are all the same? Is that a statutory requirement?
That's statutory. I mean, in this case, if you buy the basic limits and you are an insured, Shelters, I guess, takes the position that all insureds are covered. Again, the named insured, the resident relative, and the permissive. There's no different coverage for different insurers in that circumstance.
And what's a statutory provision?
10.4.620.
Thank you.
Likewise, if you're an insured under a specific policy providing higher limits, where you negotiate specific coverages, whether mandatory or negotiated, all insureds ought to be entitled to the same type of coverage.
Also, can I just ask you, so I mean, you're basically saying we're not going to let anyone bargain for higher coverage for drivers that are going to drive all the time that you know about, and lesser coverage for, I don't know, more tangential drivers, the permissive driver. Your position, and we should not let anyone bargain for that coverage. Is that correct?
No, you can bargain. You can bargain for the minimal limits, or you can bargain for higher coverage. But when you bargain for higher coverage, and insured.
But we're not going to let anybody have different coverage for different kinds, to bargain for that kind of coverage. I mean, you can imagine the cost would potentially be less, correct? If you have lower coverage for the permissive driver. And I guess your position is we're not going to let you make that decision as a consumer.
Division's permission or position is that that's not good policy. It's unfair to consumers. It creates uncertainty. It creates problems in the insurance market. The classic example is Bruce Brown in this case. He gives his son permission to drive, and his son is out there in harm's way and doesn't have the coverage that he bargained for. Under no fault or currently, the definition of insured has not changed. It's always been the named insured, resident relatives, and permissive drivers. And that's because it's not possible, it's likely that other people will drive your car. And those of you who drive, the people you give permission to drive are people you generally care about. The division believes that, from its experience, that people, when they buy the higher limits, they want it for everybody that's going to drive that car.
So your argument based on the definition of insured?
It is.
It's not a policy basis that we think it's better to have all three covered. It's based on the definition of insured in the statutes, right?
It is. The definition of insured was the same before No Fault as it is now, and the Shelter policy changes the definition. They do talk about the named insured, resident relatives, but when they get to permissive drivers, they change it and say that the permissive driver now is only entitled to the statutory minimums under Colorado law. That's a significant change.
So is it your position that the definition of insureds implicitly means not only do all of this, these classes have to be insured, but they have to be insured equally?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Well, I guess I'm out of time. 5 minutes goes pretty quick. Thank you.
Since we've just been dealing with the issue of the definition of the insured, and it's been a subject of a lot of discussion today, just to clarify, the policy, Shelter's policy I don't think changes the definition of an insured. We're looking really at a two-step process. Who is an insured? And then for those people who are insured solely because they're permissive drivers under that subsection in shelter's policy, then what are the limits? With respect to who is an insured, permissive drivers are still insureds. That hasn't changed. The issue is this step-down limit enforceable for them? Nothing removes permissive drivers from being insureds, and coverage is still available to them, just at lesser limits. With respect to the argument that was just presented, that permissive drivers tend to be people that we trust or family members that don't live in our household, you know, there is an option here. There's the insured can bargain for coverage for those people. They can add them as additional insureds. The risk that needs to be avoided here is the risk that an insurance company is going to have to pay for a loss for somebody who ends up being an insured that they cannot foresee. The person, four people down the line of loaning the car is arguably still a permissive driver because they got permission from somebody who got permission from three other people down the line. We don't know what that person's going to do, whether they're going to take the car out on a drug run or whether they're just going to go out and be reckless in that regard. So, as a matter of policy, I think it's going to create more certainty by allowing insurers to control at least some aspect of that risk by saying we're at least going to limit our losses here to the minimum liability limits in Colorado. With that said, we have a discussion with respect to notice. I'd submit that even if you would find that shelter's notice is not sufficient, that the step-down limit is worth, it should be determined the validity of it today. It's an issue that I think is going to keep coming up. It continues in shelter's policy, and I believe it'll come up in other policies as well. Thank you.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank all counsel for your arguments. Case stands submitted, and the court will be in